This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. A week from tomorrow, the new Charles H. Coolidge National Medal of Honor Heritage Center opens its doors here in Chattanooga. The opening exhibit will feature a large collection of medals and stories about their recipients. Keith Hardison is the center's executive director. Keith, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us on the program.
Well, the time has come for the Medal of Honor Center, named for Charles Coolidge.
Absolutely. Our ship has finally come in, as they would say.
Took a long road to get there.
It was a very challenging road, but I think the fact that we did it, and did it particularly in the short time that was allotted, I think speaks volumes not only for the project, but for the community that supported it.
And for people who hear the name Charles Coolidge,
yes,
but they don't know the history, especially people who are new to Chattanooga, they don't know the history. Tell
right.
us a little more about Charles Coolidge.
Well, Charles Coolidge was a technical sergeant in World War II. He served in North Africa, served in Italy, served in France and Germany. As he likes to tell the story, that he walked 1,200 miles, fighting pretty much all the way. So he was in combat a lot, and his claim to fame occurred in the fall of 1944.
Near the end of World War II.
Right. When he, with what was largely a green company, new recruits, was ordered to hold the line on a particular hill near the French-German border. They were significantly outnumbered, and Mr. Coolidge was the ranking officer, all the rest being killed or wounded. And they were attacked over a period of several days by a unit that outnumbered them 4-1, backed by tanks. One point in the engagement, of course, there was a parley about surrender initiated by Mr. Coolidge, and a couple of Germans met he and another sergeant in the unit between the lines, and much to the astonishment of the Germans, Coolidge, outnumbered 4-1, asked if they wanted to surrender. And, of course, they did not, were insulted by that. So the battle raged. Coolidge and his men were attacked multiple times. They eventually brought up two German tanks. Mr. Coolidge got within 25 yards of that tank. Turret pops open. German officer, head pops out. He speaks perfect English. And he says, "Mac, you want to surrender?" To which Mr. Coolidge answered, "Well, bud, I guess you're just going to have to come and get us." And then the tank and Mr. Coolidge played a sort of pinball. Mr. Coolidge said, "When I saw the turret go to the right, I ran to the left," and vice versa. He was shot at five times directly by the tank. Each one missed, and they held their position for 3.5 days until they were directed to withdraw the line.
And for that, he was awarded the Medal of Honor.
He received the Medal of Honor. In an unusual twist, most individuals who were awarded the medal were taken out of combat, usually brought to Washington, and the president awarded the medal. I guess they forgot Mr. Coolidge because he was still in combat, and then the Army realized he had not been withdrawn, and so they sent General Hazlip on a puddle jumper plane to go into a bombed-out German airfield to present the medal. He and Mr. Coolidge did a full regimental review. We have the tape. We have the film of that, which is very, very unusual to have film of an in-theater presentation of a Medal of Honor, and that'll be part of the exhibit.
Chattanooga's connection to the Medal of Honor predates Charles Coolidge.
Oh, yes. Really, the level of connection between Chattanooga and the Medal of Honor is totally astonishing at different periods in history. But what many people don't know is that Chattanooga is the birthplace of the Medal of Honor. It was created by the Union Army and the Civil War. The first award was in 1863 to the Andrews Raiders. Most people know that as the Great Locomotive Chase that ended near Ringgold, Georgia. The first four medals were awarded to members of that raid. Ultimately, an additional 15 were awarded, and they managed, because of transfers and paperwork issues, to miss two more. The paperwork is now in Washington for those gentlemen by the name of Shadrach and Wilson to receive those honors as well. But then, in addition to those 19, in 1863, within 25 miles of where we're sitting, another 33 medal actions occurred in combat at Wehatchee, Lookout Mountain, Chickamauga, Ringgold Gap, Missionary Ridge, and literally there is no place in America, and I doubt in the world, but certainly not in America, where there are that concentration of medals of honor awarded in that period of time. It's just absolutely astonishing. And then on top of that, you have a sort of later influx. For instance, you've got Charles Coolidge. You have Desmond Doss, who wasn't born in Chattanooga. He got here as quick as he could, spent several years of his life here. You also have General Gillespie, who was born in Kingsport, enlisted in the Army here during the Civil War, and he redesigned the Army Medal around turn of the century. So the Army Medal was redesigned by a Tennessean with Chattanooga ties. In addition to that, you have people like Paul Huff, first paratrooper to receive the Medal of Honor. He was from Cleveland. And I should say Desmond Doss was the first conscientious objector to receive the Medal of Honor. He wanted to serve his country because of some things in his life and some promises he made. He refused to carry a gun, and he had to fight for his constitutional right to serve against an enemy without being armed. He won that fight and then astonished people on Okinawa at a little place that most folks know from a movie called Hacksaw Ridge. And unarmed, Desmond Doss, well, the Army says 75 men. Doss wasn't keeping up and said it was probably less, but he was a little busy on that ridge for several days. There is research that has been done that indicates that he may have actually assisted 232 men over a period of multiple days. Again, all without a gun, and saying as he would rescue each one and send them by a rope line down the ridge to a field hospital, he would say, "Lord, let me help just one more." And again, "Lord, just let me help one more." You've got people like that. You've got Ray Duke from Whitwell. You've got Ray Cooley, an amazing array of Medal of Honor recipients that came after the first batch and had some connection with the Chattanooga area being home, and then seven Medal of Honor recipients being buried in the Chattanooga National Cemetery. This is just really astounding, and when people ask me why Chattanooga, and I share this information with them, then I ask them a question, is there anywhere else in the United States that this could be done? And of course, they're totally astounded, and the answer is no. There is no place like Chattanooga in terms of Medal of Honor history, depth, and breadth of what it means. So I like to refer to Chattanooga, and I would love for this to catch on, but we're the birthplace of the Medal of Honor, so we are the home of heroes. We're a very patriotic community, a lot of military retirees. We have this rich military history, and we have this amazing Medal of Honor history. So it is a very unique place.
And we've read a number of profiles in just the past weeks of African-American Medal of Honor winners.
Yes, absolutely. There were, I believe, 88 Medal of Honor recipients, African-American, starting with the Civil War on up to present time. We have one of those, Melvin Morris, who is on our honorary board. We now have 8 Medal of Honor recipients on the board. In addition, we have an interesting individual from Tennessee. He wasn't from Chattanooga, but he was from Williamson County, just below Nashville. At the end of the Civil War, as a young man, he decided to enlist in the Union Army. Served in the infantry, then joined the cavalry, became a member of Company K of the 9th U.S. Cavalry. It's one of two units that were known as Buffalo Soldiers. People have varying explanations of why African-American units were called Buffalo Soldiers, but the real reason is that the United States military formed 4 cavalry regiments, 2 white, 2 African-American. They sent the white regiments to the Northern Plains and the African-American regiments to the Southern Plains, and obviously not being real climatologically savvy, said, "Well, it's desert. It never gets cold in the desert. They don't need overcoats." Obviously, they'd never been to the desert. It snows in the desert. It gets cold at night. And so African-American troops were forced to kill buffalo and make coats and hats and gloves out of them. So the Indians called them the soldiers who used the buffalo. So they were buffalo soldiers, 9th and 10th Cav. So we tell the story of George Jordan. And in our unique exhibits, you're going to round a corner, and he's hard charging on his horse right at you as if you were the Apaches that he chased in the Southwest. Was told on one occasion when he was leading a patrol of men through that the area was infested with Indians and that he should turn back for his own safety. He was told that by a Mexican army officer. Their unit had crossed the border, and he said, well, I've been given an order to reach this area, and I am going to reach this area, dangerous or not. That's my paraphrase of it. But he was nominated twice to receive the Medal of Honor, received it once. And that is an interesting story in that when we talk about Medal of Honor recipients and their character traits, one of them is patriotism, another is citizenship. Well, here was a man who was denied full citizenship rights, still went out and served his country, and did so in a rather amazing manner. So that's just some of the stories we tell, and we look for a situation that our approach is not, we've got lots and lots of good stuff, come see it. Now, we have some very prime artifacts, don't get me wrong, but our focus is come be a part of their stories. Learn what makes them tick. There's six character traits that studies have indicated that pretty well characterize all the Medal of Honor recipients. And incidentally, Medals of Honor are rare. If you take the total number of folks who have served in the American military between its inception during the Civil War and the current time, the average is, in very rough terms, about 1 in 1 million in terms of receiving the Medal of Honor. World War II, you had a little over 400. And we mentioned Charles Coolidge. He is one of two that is left from World War II recipients. And he's the oldest at 98 years and counting.
Still in this area.
Still in this area, Signal Mountain. And we hope to be able to see him at the opening ceremony, in which that would be a very unique thing because Kyle Carpenter, who has a new book out, who fought the Taliban and received a Medal of Honor in Afghanistan, is going to be there too. And so he's 30, so we would have the oldest and the youngest at the same place at the same time, separated by only 68 years. So we have a remarkable slate of remarkable exhibits, remarkable amount of people who are coming, slate of activities, etc.
And where can people go online for more information?
The best place to go is our new website, www.mohhc, for Medal of Honor Heritage Center.org.
All right, Keith, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jonathan Gruber makes a case for investing in innovation in dozens of cities in Middle America, beyond the marquee cluster of zip codes. The economist at MIT is the author of Jumpstart America, How Breakthrough Science Can Revive Economic Growth and the American Dream. Next week, he'll be speaking here in Chattanooga on Thursday at the EDNY, starting at 5 p.m., followed by a panel discussion, an event organized by the Enterprise Center. Jonathan joined us by phone for a preview, starting with his book.
The idea of the book is to recognize that a lot of what made America grow so rapidly in the post-war decades was government sponsorship of research and development, that so much of what became our modern economy, both in terms of the products we use and the jobs we have, were run through government R&D projects. We used to lead the world by spending 2% of our entire gross national product on public research and development. Today, we spend 0.6%, and we're 13th in the world. And we think that that has been a major drag on the growth of the U.S. economy. But we think more than that, that the problem is that the research and development that we do, and increasingly the innovation economy, is focused on just a few coastal hubs, and the benefits have not really been spread around the country. And so the point of our book is that we think that there needs to be more of investment in research and development in our nation, but it needs to be done in a way that the benefits are shared with all places, like Chattanooga, not just with Cambridge and San Francisco.
So how do you propose we do that?
What we do in the book is we first sort of go through the history of sort of how public R&D was so successful in building the U.S. economy, and then we talk about the economics of why the private sector isn't doing enough R&D, isn't doing the kind of breakthrough science we need. And then we talk about places in America that can be next-generation tech hubs. We went to the data and we said, how many places in America are big? They have more than 100,000 working-age population. They're well-educated. At least 25% of the population has a college education. And they're affordable. And the average house price is less than $260,000 a year. We camp with 102 cities in 36 states with 80 million people in them. Places like Chattanooga, places with good universities and a good quality of life and a well-educated population, but right now not places that are really the epicenters of innovation that we're seeing in San Francisco and Boston, New York. So our proposal is that the federal government learn from Amazon. What did Amazon do when they wanted an HQ2? They held a competition. They said to cities, you can apply to be our new HQ2, and 230 cities around the country applied. We want to have a competition, but unlike Amazon's competition, which was basically who can give us the biggest tax break, we have a competition which is which places can create the best new tech hubs, can put together a coalition of business leaders, educational leaders, and local politicians to create the preconditions for becoming a new tech hub, and then have a federal competition where the winning places would get a major injection, billions of dollars of federal funding, to create the infrastructure and other support you need to become a place that technology can bloom.
Why is the geographic dimension of what you're proposing so important for its success?
I think it's important in two senses. One sense is economic, which is that basically we have a situation where R&D is being concentrated in a few very expensive places, and that I think is limiting the amount of R&D we can do. It's too expensive to do R&D in Cambridge. Kendall Square now costs as much as Midtown Manhattan in terms of real estate prices. But I think more important is political, which is that basically we have created a system where when you talk about science, people outside of a few cities feel left out. They feel like, well, more science just means more money to a few coastal cities. It doesn't really matter for my community. And we think that the geographic dimension is important to explain to the rest of the country that there are many places around the potential to become next-generation tech hubs, and we need to take an active role in encouraging that.
Another thing I wanted to focus on here was the level of skill in the jobs created by this approach. Are we talking all or largely PhDs? Because if we are, that's leaving out a lot of people who need good-paying jobs.
No, in fact, we're not talking largely PhDs. One, the manager at the Central Florida Research Park, which is a very prominent research park, which is a model we just use in the book, said that he's told that for every PhD scientist, you need 10 lab techs. So we are talking about jobs that require skills. We're not talking about unskilled jobs, but they're not PhDs. They're not necessarily even four-year college degrees. It's really about having technical skills to work in high value-added jobs, which means more education than a lot of people have, and part of the proposals places would put in to become next-generation tech hubs would include how they're going to provide their population those technical skills. But it's not PhDs, it's not even necessarily college degrees. It's about the kind of high value-added jobs that are throughout the chain when you create high-tech products, from the scientists to the lab techs all the way to the administrative assistants. You need to make the company function well, and these are good-paying jobs.
What about the concerns about automation and AI wiping out whole classes of jobs?
Look, as we say, the robots are coming. The question is, who's going to make the robots? So if your concern is about automation taking away jobs, the answer is not to fight automation. We can't fight automation. It's coming whether we like it or not. If we try to fight it in the U.S., it'll just come in other countries. But what we should do is recognize that if robots are coming, that means a whole lot of high-value-added jobs in making those robots. And we need to be the folks that make the robots. The robots are going to get made. The question is, will they be made in the U.S. or will they be made in China? And that's really the key decision before us, is are we going to make the investments? China is making the investments in basic science they need to be the leading country that makes the robots, that makes these new technologies. We're backing off from those commitments, and we need to lean in.
Another challenge here is the federal government committing to spend the money at a time where we now have an election season and we have all of this political polarization in Washington and elsewhere in the country. What do you think it's going to take to break through that logjam for folks in Washington to consider what you're proposing and spend some money?
Well, I think what it takes is really pretty basic, which is just a recognition that science investments leads to new jobs. Look, everyone wants jobs. This isn't a red or blue issue. Jobs is a bipartisan issue. And I think what we need to do is make sure people recognize the tie-in between investing in science and creating good, high value added jobs. And that's why we think the geographic components are important, because we think every place from Chattanooga to other cities have economic development officers who are interested in bringing jobs to their city, creating good, high value added jobs. And I think if we can get the politicians to realize that the way to do that is to invest in science, then I think we can bring the kind of bipartisan support that an ambitious agenda like this needs.
And it's really back to the future, you're arguing, because we have this history, not only in terms of coming out of World War II, but even before that, we have a history of doing these types of things.
We have a big history post-World War II, but it's not just ancient history. So one of the examples we use in the book is the example of the Human Genome Project, which was a project that was first proposed by private companies, but they could not do it without government funding. So the government invested $3 billion over 13 years to map the human genome so that we could understand the mechanisms through which genetics determine our lifestyle and help us figure out which drugs might help us fight disease. Well, that investment was made in the 1990s, and today the genomics industry in America has 270,000 jobs paying an average salary of $70,000 a year. This is the kind of thing we can create when we put our minds to government investments in new industries.
What message do you have to offer for people here in Chattanooga when you come here?
I think the message for Chattanooga is that everybody wants to be a tech hub. Everybody's talking about that. That's not new to Chattanooga. Everybody's talking about that. The difference is, I think, right now it's incredibly hard for places like Chattanooga to compete with the coastal superpowers like Boston and New York and San Francisco, because there's so much concentration of economic innovation in those places that it's hard for Chattanooga to break through the noise. So what you need is you need a real jumpstart. You need a real initiative where the federal government can put in the resources that are needed to create new tech hubs, to actually create places that can compete with these giants on the coast. And that's not going to happen. I mean, our feeling is that's not going to happen just with the limited resources a place like Chattanooga or the state of Tennessee have. That's going to require the federal government to commit to major new investments and commit to making them around the country, not just in a few cities.
All right. Jonathan Gruber, thanks so much.
Yeah, you bet. My pleasure.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More after our news with Bill McLean. This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Joel Tippins is known for urban gardening here in Chattanooga. Now, the community activist is working on a new endeavor, the City Farms Grower Coalition. The project will provide hands-on learning in organic farming to a new crop of urban growers, from seeding trays in the greenhouse, to planting at schools, churches, gardens, and vacant spaces, to selling fresh food to the community. Joel stopped by Scenic Roots. Joel, thanks for joining us.
Oh, I appreciate the invitation.
How did you get into urban farming?
This actually began back when I lived in Daytona Beach, Florida, and realized that there was no community garden in my area, and I found some folks. Back then, Meetup was quite popular. We started a little Meetup garden group. The Lions Club gave us some property to use and wound up with a pretty nice community garden, a lot of homeschool moms. And then the newspaper did a little article, and that grew into some more interest with a schoolyard garden, the fourth graders. We revitalized the Ponce Inlet Lighthouse Garden on the grounds where the lightkeeper used to grow some food for his kitchen. And we did a little community garden at a charter high school for teenage moms. And the school used the garden program to help teach nutrition to young high school mothers. There was a pastor here in Chattanooga that I have connections with that go way back at New City Fellowship. And he made me an offer much like the Godfather. I could not refuse. And said, if you'll bring your organization here to Chattanooga, we'll hire you. So I moved to Chattanooga in 2011, and I was kind of the hippie garden guy on staff at New City Fellowship in Glenwood. And that was the site of the first garden project I did, was there on the church grounds. And they still utilize that space with their youth program called GLAAD. We wound up down on East Main Street at the invitation of a neighborhood association, where we established a community garden on an asphalt parking lot, decided we could demonstrate to people how you don't have to have the best soil, you don't even have to have any soil, but you can grow food even on a vacant parking lot. That is now being utilized with a refugee resettlement ministry. It's now the Taking Root Community Garden, and there's many different nations represented there. I've done some garden work with a little urban farm in Avondale up in the East Chattanooga area called Grow Hope Urban Farm. So over the years, I've just kind of found myself moving deeper and deeper into urban farming.
You talked about soil. What else does it take to build an urban garden and make sure that it grows?
Well, you know, the first thing you need is some passion. It is a lifestyle. One day I'm going to have some bumper stickers made that say, you just think you want a garden. Because a lot of people attend workshops this time of year. It starts warming, things start blooming. And they think, man, I want to grow some chard and carrots and tomatoes. And then the next thing you know, it's 95 and the bugs have moved in and the weeds are tall. Folks go back to watching Netflix in the afternoon instead of gardening. So I would say it obviously starts with a gardener. It really is a lifestyle and may require a paradigm shift about how you spend your time, what you invest your energy in, but you get good food out of it. Soil is very important because you're not really raising plants. You're actually raising herds of microscopic life down there where the roots play. And so if you take care of those herds of microscopic bacteria and fungi, amazing creatures down there, sight unseen. If you provide them a healthy habitat, then that results in healthy garden plants, which results in good food and healthy people.
And you are devoting your passion now to a new project.
Yeah, since moving here in 2011 and being involved in various aspects of urban gardening and urban agriculture. And I've tried to be very intentional about paying attention to who's doing what and what their strengths are and where are some gaps that need to be filled. And that has resulted in a new initiative called City Farms Grower Coalition. And we're just launching it with this growing season. We're in a greenhouse right now over on the west side, getting ready to start all the little seedlings for the early spring crops. What we saw was a great need was people who could show up with a wheelbarrow and some tools, with folks that want to start a garden and don't really know where to begin. Or maybe they've identified vacant space and they have a number of folks that would love to join in with a community effort, but they just need some hands-on instruction. So rather than talking about gardening around a table and looking at handouts, we've decided that the best education model for growing food is hands-on and an experiential learning opportunity. So City Farms Grower Coalition we'll have a training program with multiple campuses around the city as we recruit other churches to transform some of the lawn that they mow into food gardens or community garden. We can point to a couple of churches who are doing that and use that as a learning space. We have the ability to demonstrate in a training setting multiple applications. Tires make tremendous containers to grow food in, and they are free. You can grow in raised beds. You can spade good soil in the ground. I've grown food in the bed of a pickup truck. Got a lot of attention when I would stop for gas in the pickup truck, but The key is, I think there are communities that could benefit from having increased access to fresh, nutritious, local food. They just don't really know where to start. They don't really know how to begin.
We hear all the time about food deserts here in Chattanooga.
Yeah. Yeah, Chattanooga lost several grocery stores just a few short years ago. And, of course, those weren't decisions that the community made. No one said, you know, we don't really need a grocery store anymore. Just take it away. Those decisions are made in corporate boardrooms by important people in some high-rise somewhere in a bigger city than Chattanooga. And, yeah, you're left doing your shopping at a corner store or the dollar store or a gas station. I mean, there's a gas station near my house with a little, you know, takeout that has the most delicious potato logs and chicken tenders, but it's loaded with that nice fatty batter, raising your cholesterol and heart rate. So it's really a social justice issue that your address in the neighborhood that you live in the city, that should not determine the results of the health of your household. So we look at having the ability to train people to act on some sovereignty, you know, a little food sovereignty. Let me take control over this one thing in my life that I can provide some fresh, nutritious food to my kitchen table and raise the nutrition level of my household. Plus, it's just a great exercise and a lot of fun.
You're raising money now, and we have the growing season ahead of us. Beyond that, what are your plans for this?
We're hoping one of our new partners for this growing season is the Bethlehem Center in Alton Park. We're hoping to be able to, you know, it sounds really good. This is 2020, so we want to raise up 20 new growers in 2020, and it may be 17, but that doesn't sound as cool as 20 in 2020. No matter how many new growers we train and raise up here in the community, we're looking at folks that can provide not only food for their own household, but we can show you how to grow a whole lot more in a lot less space than you thought you needed, and then contribute that to a new farmers market there in Alton Park at the Bethlehem Center. We're going to be helping them with their children's garden. We want to find some folks in Alton Park that might have the notion to join a community garden. There's lots of vacant space all over the city that could be growing food. Bethlehem Center is, you know, they've been there forever. They're just like a treasure in the city of Chattanooga, and it's a privilege to be able to partner with them. Our calendar is different than the school calendar or maybe the corporate fiscal calendar. We kind of have to go with the seasons that God created. And so we're right now looking at getting in the greenhouse, getting the little seedlings started so that in the early spring we can start putting out some of those cool weather crops, lots of collard greens, some beets and carrots, and then get those tomatoes and peppers healthy in there on the growing tables so that once the frost date rolls past, we can look at some warm soil and put those plants out there where they'll be happy. And we would love to be able to create some product as a revenue stream, as earned income for the organization. So one thing I'm looking at is maybe our own salsa, maybe the City Farms salsa. And so you can be looking for that at farmers markets and possibly be able to buy it online at our website. But that's the big picture, is charity is a good thing. Charity is wonderful, and it makes us feel good when we're able to donate that way. But charity is also kind of like salt water in a bucket. It can rust a hole. And then what usually is lost from that hole in the bucket is dignity. We like to empower people and recognize that innate dignity that we all have. And so teaching people how to earn some income with the food that they're growing, I think, is very, very important.
And where can people go online for more information?
You can find us on Facebook. I think everything in the world is on Facebook, and we are too. So you just look for City Farms Grower Coalition on Facebook and like our page, and you'll find our GoFundMe campaign there. The GoFundMe campaign, if you went to their website and searched for Let's Plant the Farm in the City, and that'll show you where you can generously donate to help support this effort. And then you can always shoot me an email, and I can respond and get you connected. And my email is joel@wedigcityfarms.org.
All right, Joel, thanks so much.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
At the end of this month, the Chattanooga Audubon Society hosts its first Torchlight Gala on the water. It's a riverboat cruise on the Southern Belle on Saturday, February 29th, starting at 7 p.m. Darlene Carlson is the Society's Executive Director.
Darlene, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So the Torchlight Gala, this is a first for the Chattanooga Audubon Society.
Correct, yes. Chattanooga Audubon protects about 450 acres in Hamilton County. We've been here since 1944. So we celebrated our 75th anniversary last year. And so this is a fundraiser. It is on the Southern Belle Riverboat, which actually circles McClellan Island, which is one of our sanctuary properties.
And for folks who have not been to McClellan Island or haven't been there for a long time, what do they see there now?
Well, it's an interesting place. It is truly a urban preserve down there. You can see McClellan Island from the walking bridge. Veterans Bridge crosses over the one tip of the island. What's interesting about that is it actually forms a desert environment under the bridge there, which is one of the ecosystems that you can actually see while you're visiting. You have to get there by boat, kayak, canoe, paddleboard, however, but it's water access only. And it's got a diversity of plant life. It's got osprey nests, blue heron nesting, the food source for the migrating warblers. So there's lots of stuff there.
The Torchlight Gala, there's a reason why you're calling it that.
Correct, yes. Robert Sparks Walker founded the Chattanooga Audubon Society in 1944, and he wrote a Pulitzer Prize-nominated book called Torchlight to the Cherokees. It is about the Brainerd Mission Project, which was one of the first of its kind in the U.S. that educated blacks, whites, and Native Americans together in one place.
And where did the idea come from to have the Torchlight Gala?
Well, it was a board decision. We were looking for a fundraiser in the months when we're really slow. We don't get any federal, state, or, you know, that type of funding. We are a privately owned entity. So we survive on donations from the public and a few other events that we do during the year.
So tell us more about what's going to happen at the gala on the boat.
It's going to include a dinner, and it's going to include a program that Audubon is putting together, including a video that talks about our mission and what we're hoping to accomplish with the funds raised at the gala, which is actually to continue to maintain our existing sanctuary properties. But we're also having a Native American flute and drum duo called Crazy Flute doing some performance for us on the Southern Belle. They are actually an award-winning Native American duo, so we're real excited about having them come.
And then beyond the gala, what else can you tell us is going on this year?
Well, we're having a new program on March 30th, 31st, and April 1st. Which is called Avian Discovery Days, which is gauged for elementary school kids. So that is a new educational program that we're adding to Audubon this year. We're real excited to continue to increase our educational offerings to the public. We did Pioneer Days in November, which a lot of kids attended. About 2,000 students attended that. That was fun.
And where can people go online for more information?
ChattanoogaAudubon.org. That has a lot of information. It's a really good website. And specifically, /Torchlight will bring you to the Torchlight page, which will let you purchase the tickets.
All right. Darlene, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Scenic Roots on WUTC. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. Our show is produced by Haley Solomon, Carly Dodson, and Will Davis from the studios of WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Follow us on Twitter at scenicroutes423 and email us at scenicroutes423@gmail.com. Also, follow WUTC on Facebook and Instagram, and listen online anytime at wutc.org and the WUTC app. Join us again next time for Scenic Roots.